Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Diane is on a cruise with public radio listeners. Ali Etaraz struggled for years to find his identity as a Pakistani and a Muslim. Over and over again, he says, he strove to be an Islamic activist and become the embodiment of the Prophet Muhammad's religion. He eventually became an Islamic reformer. He is part of the Pakistani diaspora, the 20 or 30 million Pakistanis living away from Pakistan. His new memoir, Children of Dust, explores how Islam, Pakistan, and the United States shaped his identity. He joins me in the studio. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Good morning, Susan.
We invite our listeners to give us a call with your questions or comments. Our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. You can always send us an email at drshow@wamu.org or send us a question by Twitter or Facebook. So the title of your book, Children of Dust, what does that mean?
Well, the title is actually inspired by a verse in the Quran, chapter 17, verse 61. And in the verse, this is kind of the Islamic story of Genesis and creation, and God has created Adam and Eve, and at that moment, God asks all the angels to bow down before Adam and Eve as a sign of their respect for humankind. And Iblis, who is a jinn, and he's the Islamic Satan, or eventually becomes the Islamic Satan, refuses to bow down before Adam and Eve. And he says, "Why should I bow down before them whom you have created of dust?" Because he was created of fire. And so he felt himself superior to them. And so humanity is, you know, these creations of dust. And that's kind of what my aim was in the book to write about.
You know, you write about the promise your father made on a trip to Mecca before you were born that did so much to shape your life. What did he promise?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I don't think my father himself assigned as much importance to this at the moment, but he basically asked God for a son. And, you know, if there's kind of a cultural thing that Pakistanis do, which is this idea of the mannat, which is kind of a vow. And, you know, you ask something of God, and in return, you will try to fulfill in some religious obligation, or maybe sacrifice some animals, or, you know, give some charity, something along those lines. And so in this case, the mannat was, well, we will do our best to raise our child as a leader or a servant, or, you know, a scholar of Islam. And that was kind of the relationship that I was set up in before I was born.
And did your father often mention this? Was it something that made a great impression on you?
That's funny, because my father, I don't even know if he remembered it, but my mother remembered it very clearly. And she was sort of the catalyst for, sort of the engine for this kind of myth getting reshaped and reformulated in my head over and over again. So she became the driving force behind that.
So your early years, you grew up in rural Pakistan. Tell me about life there.
Well, we moved around a lot of places in Pakistan, including, you know, Lahore, which is a big city and mentioned at the beginning of the book where we were living. And then we moved around in Punjab, southern rural areas for a little bit. And, you know, life was, you know, the amenities obviously were not there. And things like water were sometimes very hard to get. I mean, sometimes the water would not come for 3 days and people would just have stuff stored. You know, and this is, we're talking the late 80s. At the time, I remember, you know, General Zia-ul-Haq being in power in Pakistan. He was the military dictator at the time. And just in terms of context, Benazir Bhutto was a very young, fledgling politician at the time who had just returned from overseas, from essentially in exile, after Zia-ul-Haq had hung her father. So she was kind of leading this democratic charge. In 88, I believe, there were elections in Pakistan. And we got a ton of days off for elections, you know, and you just followed on TV or radio. It was a really big deal. And but on the whole, you know, it was very hot, it was dusty, and it was kind of a tough life, especially as we were kind of struggling economically at the time.
You went to a madrasa.
Yes.
Now, madrasa, tell us, madrasa is a word that I think many Americans don't fully understand. Tell us what it means.
Well, a madrasa has become in Pakistani vernacular, madrasa is kind of a catch-all word that corresponds to many different types of places where you can study religion. And the most predominant form of the madrasa is the one that I describe in the book, where students go to either study the Quran or memorize it. And I went to the madrasa where we were supposed to memorize the Quran. And a person who memorizes the Quran is called a hafiz. And a hafiz is given quite a bit of respect within Pakistani society. And, you know, you commit the entire Arabic Quran to memory, and then during Ramadan and at various, you know, religious festivals, the hafiz come in and they recite the Quran for people. And some do it in a very stylistic way. And that's not only a good way to be, you know, respected, but also to make a lucrative career. So most of the kids that, you know, were going to the madrasa were trying to become hafiz, and they're trying to kind of become religious leaders in their communities. But obviously, as you know, now we understand madrasas in a very different light. And there's obvious truth to the fact that a number of madrasas became kind of recruiting grounds for Taliban and other militant movements, and they became very politicized.
Tell us, I'd like you to tell us a little about what life was like at the madrasa, what it was like. I wonder if you might want to read a bit of your book to give us a sense of that.
Absolutely. So this is at the time when I'm at my madrasa where I spent most of my time. And it's at that point where I had been beaten recently, and so I didn't want to go to the madrasa.
Now, beaten by whom?
The instructor, who's called a qari, and there's a preferred, like, punitive position that you were supposed to assume when you're being beaten, and you kind of bend over and you hitch your arms behind your legs and you hold on to your ears. And holding on to your ears is a sort of expression of penance or somebody who's seeking forgiveness. So you're simultaneously seeking forgiveness while you're being beaten, so with a stick. So this is the part where I am going to the madrasa. By the time we reached the madrasa, I was so empowered that I could think of a million other things I would rather be doing. I could sit in front of the cooler. I could go and swim with buffaloes, or watch Indian films, or drink glasses of sugarcane juice spiced with ginger and lemon, or get a case of mangoes and soften each one until it became soft and I could suck the juice out of it. What I didn't want to do was to recite the Quran in a room with no fans in the stale sleepiness of late afternoon. Nor did I want to be bent over in the rooster position and beaten. I missed the life I had before I was enrolled at the madrasa, the days of playing catch against my bedroom wall, dreaming of becoming an Iblis-fighting angel, the afternoons when I propped charpai beds on their sides and made a fort and called myself Saladin the Liberator, spilling oil onto the Crusaders' armies, withstanding a siege by Richard the Lionheart, and then doing diplomacy with him, during which I met with his sister and impressed her with my warrior prowess by throwing her scarf high in the air and cutting it in two perfect halves with my scimitar. I wanted to live in my imagination, not as a spindly-legged spider in the Quranic cryptograms. I didn't want to be a droning echo stuck chanting a book in a language I didn't understand. I liked the Quran at night, when Ummi told me stories from it, stories about the prophets, Yunus and Yusuf. I didn't like the Quran forced into my mouth on the authority of the Qari's big brown stick, a Quran to be chewed and vomited.
That's Ali Etarez reading from his new book called Children of Dust, a memoir of Pakistan. Our phone lines are open. You can give us a call, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. So you also attended briefly a Catholic school in Pakistan. How did that happen?
Well, I did attend a Catholic school after I had been enrolled in the madrasa. We moved, and our economic situation improved you know, tremendously in some ways. And this is right before we came to the United States. So my parents kind of felt, you know, I should be exposed to Western education more so than I was. And the Catholic school was a very good school. It was in a smaller town, but still it was recognized as a very, very good school. And so I went to school with Catholic children from that town. But the strange thing was that Christians on the whole were looked down upon as a community. And they were a very small community. And most of them had previously, I mean, decades ago, been Hindus of the lower castes. And they had converted to Christianity because the church provided them, to Catholicism, because the church provided them, you know, a lot of services. And that was an interesting experience. Unfortunately, the entirety of that didn't make it into the book. But
You then moved to the United States. You were 11 at the time.
Yes, ma'am.
Why did your family move here?
You know, probably two reasons. Economic improvement for my parents, especially my father, who wanted to be a doctor, and education for us. There was this sense in our entire family or extended family that education in Pakistan was very corrupt and that merit wasn't really the determining factor for advancement in education. And I think that my parents themselves, having gone to school in Pakistan, had seen that with their eyes, and they were reluctant to subject us to it. So
you came to the United States, and what effect did that have on your religious sense, on your sense of Islam?
Right, because I definitely think that our religious sense got strengthened by coming to America. And I think in our case, it was because that became our primary identity. Being Muslim became our primary identity, even though we were Pakistani, you know, and we were Punjabi. But those were the things that we really focused on that were religious in nature, as far as how we socialized, who we met, and the kind of people we congregated with.
Do you think that's common among Muslim families who move here from other places, that it actually intensifies their kind of identification?
I've noticed both trends now. I've noticed the trend where people become very religious and more withdrawn in a religious sense. I have noticed some people that kind of become way westernized, and there's kind of a conflict in our communities about that. You know, people don't hang out together if they're from the two different sides.
We're talking to Ali Edaraz about his new book called Children of Dust. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll go shortly to the phones, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And with me in the studio is Ali Edaraz. He's the author of Children of Dust, a memoir of Pakistan. You're now, before the break, we talked about your family's move from Pakistan to the United States. And talk a little about the struggle that you then faced about your own role as a servant of Islam.
Well, in my teenage years, I was kind of in a rebellious phase because my parents were very strictly religious and they wanted us to be inculcated with, you know, Islamic knowledge while also, you know, doing well at school in the U.S. But I kind of reacted to that, and I didn't really like to be learning about Islam and studying, you know, all this stuff. But I would never really vocally express my disagreement, and I sort of had kind of a guilt thing developing from a very early age, where I felt that merely saying that I wasn't interested, you know, in studying religion would be some sort of crime or a sin or something else, and the family pressure obviously added to that.
You know, it's funny, your book has chapters, and the chapters are all headlined, or the title of the chapters are all different names you adopted at different points in your life because of your struggle to figure out what your Islamic faith would mean to you. Talk a little about these various names we see through the book.
Right. So, you know, there was my birth name, which my parents gave me by their own inspiration in Mecca, and the name meant perfume of Islam. So the aim of that sort of identity was to to spread Islam like it was a fragrance. And later, when I was older and I was in the United States, I didn't like that name because that name is a beer. And a beer, I mean, a beer, right? That was kind of, I was mocked at school for it all the time. And also because I just didn't feel like it suited me. I didn't feel like that's who I was. So I, you know, started agitating at home to be allowed to change my name. And I ended up changing it to Amir.
Now, did your parents mind that?
Actually, surprisingly, my dad was pretty cool with it. And my mom, she had some objections, you know, because she felt like, again, like I said, she was the engine between like my Islam and me. And so she kind of objected to it, but ultimately she agreed.
Now, then you became much more fundamentalistic in your thinking. What did you call yourself then?
Well, at that time, I was kind of, you know, playing with these various identities that would allow my religion to come out, and not just my religion to be expressed in very serious ways, but also to connect me to Islamic history. Because at the time, I became very conservative, and I would say fundamentalist was when I went off to New York for college. And so after having left the South, the American South, and gone to New York, I was kind of in this state of culture shock. And Islam and then more conservative versions of Islam were what were available to me as sort of a crutch. And I really wanted to be connected to the history of Islam at that point. And so the name I adopted as kind of my surname, my pen name, whatever, was Abu Bakr Ramak, which was supposed to connect me to the first caliph, to whom the first caliph of Islam, and to whom I thought I was related at the time.
And what about your name now? What does that mean to you?
Ali Etraz kind of came about during my activism as when I was involved with, you know, religious reform and liberal Islamic movements. And the name itself means a noble protest. And I felt that it embodied my religious activism very well, especially when I was trying to stand up for kind of justice and fairness and gender equity in the face of extremist or, you know, fundamentalist.
So you went from being a servant of Islam to a reformer of Islam, someone who wants change in the Islamic faith. How did that happen?
Well, after 9/11, nothing happened to me in a kind of material sense, even in emotional sense. I just became very withdrawn. But it took about 5 years of just kind of being subjected to seeing a lot of violence in the name of Islam, where I felt like I had to say something, and I had to kind of rise up and, you know, make a point that this kind of violence in the name of Islam was an insult to the religion. It was an insult to our community. And so I became extremely involved in activism at that time. And it lasted for a good, you know, good period of time.
You went back to Pakistan in 1999, and you found that the madrasa that you had gone to was really a different kind of place. How had it changed?
Oh, so we're moving back in time a little bit. You're right. In 1999, I went to Pakistan. And the madrasas that I saw at that time, first of all, the ones that dominated the attention of the people were the ones that were kind of recruiting grounds. And other than that, I just remember thinking that Pakistan has so much more of this militant rhetoric. Not more. Pakistan has militant rhetoric, which it didn't in the late 80s when I was at the madrasas. And, you know, when I was at the madrasas, the whole point to go there was so that people would stay out of trouble. And all of a sudden, if you were kind of involved with religious groups in Pakistan in the late 90s, you were in trouble, you were causing trouble, you were, you know, like I discuss in the book, that you were thugs, you were extortionists, you know, any number of things. And I had my encounter with these bullies who were wearing very religious garb. They had a very religious demeanor, and they essentially wanted to excommunicate me from Islam because I was an American, and they thought that I was a CIA agent, which was obviously a shock because I had gone back in such a kind of pious state. I felt like, oh, you know, I will have community and brotherhood with Muslims because we're Muslims. And it did not work like that.
You know, we talk a lot about Pakistan on our Friday News Roundup. Pakistan very much at the center of U.S. interest in that region. What do you think is happening in Pakistan now in terms of the situation with the Taliban, with Al-Qaeda?
You know, I have now heard so many theories, and it's so easy to kind of make this purely a religious narrative, but from having talked to Pakistanis and people who are living there, you know, it's what's happened in Pakistan is not something that occurred after 9/11. It's not something that occurred after the Afghan war at the end of the Afghan war in the early 90s. It's something that's kind of been going on in Pakistan since its founding, which is that there's competing interests from feudal owners, landowners, to industrialists, to a peasant class, to a middle class that doesn't really exist. And there's ethnic strife between various groups in Pakistan. And the most compelling theory that explains a lot of this for me is that the Taliban are now a manifestation of the dispossessed, you know, Pashtun people of the Northwest region, and also a lot of the former peasants of the Punjab area. And they've acquired religious garb. I actually wrote an article a while back on Dissent Magazine's website exploring how in Pakistan, pretty much every politician from the military to the civil politicians over the course of 30, 40 years started putting their political interest in religious clothing. And I think that now the dispossessed classes are doing the same thing. And unfortunately, it's creating a lot more violence.
I'd like to invite some of our listeners to join our conversation. We'll go first to Dade. He's calling us from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Dade.
Hi. I've sort of changed my question as I listened. Is there any equivalent? We have a lot of violence in this country, of course, and we have a small group of Catholics that really teach nonviolence. Does Islam have in its youth any group that has sort of can counter the fanaticism of the suicide bombers with a nonviolent and any peace, I mean, real peace movement within Islam?
All right, Dade, thanks for your call.
Well, it's an interesting question because that is kind of what I felt that I was involved with for about 3 or 4 years, starting in about 2005, this kind of reformist element. And it's interesting because on one hand, you have already an established narrative in Islam, which is very peace and very civil in its engagement, which is, you know, obviously sometimes known as Sufism. And that has been such a long-standing part of Islamic history. But I think what we're finding now in today's conflict is that Sufism is in many ways inadequate to counter a lot of these extremists, because the violence in many ways is political, and the violence has roots that really don't necessarily always stem from within religion. And so you can't have religious engagement because there's really nothing to discuss as far as the doctrine go. You know, you have some debates and discussions that take place, and there's condemnations that take place. You know, a big Sufi group in Pakistan condemned bin Laden and even excommunicated him right after 9/11. But, you know, what did that really achieve? It was a kind of a symbolic gesture, but it didn't make any real real inroads.
Dave, did you want to ask anything else?
Well, I wondered too about the mentality of a suicide bomber when so many of us love life and treasure it. It must be very difficult to conquer that and to take your own life, let alone others. Any insight on that?
Well, it's interesting. I think the person that has most illuminated the act of political suicide for me has been Albert Camus, the French philosopher. And his kind of take, and I might be butchering this completely, but his take was that suicide is ultimately a very rational act. And so a lot of these suicide bombers, their intention is to engage in act of warfare, and they understand themselves as weapons, and it's a very rational decision that ultimately cannot be reduced to, you know, madness or anything along those lines.
Well, what do you think about these suicide bombers that we've seen in Pakistan? It's been a case in Iraq and Afghanistan against U.S. troops. What is your view?
Well, you know, obviously, as a Muslim, you condemn it. You condemn the loss of all violence, all life, and the unnecessary violence is just extremely, extremely disappointing. Obviously, you know, I feel repeatedly that people are being put to do these acts, the suicide bombings especially, by men who are essentially like calculating warlords and calculating generals and militia leaders. And until we're able to talk to these youth and tell them that they're being manipulated, I feel that suicide bombing, which has become basically a weapon of choice, is going to continue.
We have had this terrible shooting in Fort Hood, Texas, just in recent days, by a Muslim who talked a lot about the conflict he felt between his faith and his service in the armed forces. What do you make of that? And I wonder if you worry about a backlash or what this does to Americans who are not Muslims when they look at the Islamic faith.
Well, I'm going to take the second part of the question. Is very interesting because I happen to be, you know, one of those Muslims who believe that America has been extremely good to Muslims. I mean, given 9/11, given a lot of the violence that has occurred in the name of Islam, and it has, I've moved all over the U.S. and I've interacted with Americans, regular everyday Americans from South, Northwest, Southwest, whatever, and I just find that there is such a warmth there that people are embracing of Islam. Obviously, there have been acts of violence. You know, there have been acts of prejudice and bigotry. But ultimately, I feel that America is a very, very tolerant and very inclusive place. And that really is something that Muslim Americans do recognize. Muslim Americans, for the most part, when they go overseas, when they go to Europe, when they go to other parts of the Muslim world even, often will talk about how good America is as a place to live and practice your religion. So, you know, that is something that it has to be first and foremost. Obviously, the shooting itself was extremely, extremely tragic, you know, and painful for many Muslims. I'm not a Muslim leader, so I can't be speaking for other Muslims and condemning it on the broad scale. But personally, you know, it was shocking. I'm just like you in many ways, following the facts about, you know, the major and trying to figure out what happened. I did read the PowerPoint presentation that Washington Post published about his views of Islam that, you know, he was presenting to a lot of the doctors, and it's very conflicted. You know, on one hand, he's demonstrating there's verses in the Quran that, you know, eschew violence that are about the sanctity of life, but at the same time, he's talking about the offensive Islam of the future, and it's there's a reference to like an apocalyptic theology in there, and you know, he one of the strange things that I noticed was he goes into this idea of abrogation, which is this kind of very complex legal thing within Islamic law, but basically it says that the earliest verses that were revealed in the Quran have been superseded by the later verses, and so by using that point, he takes like the more violent or military verses that occur in the Quran and says that they applied to all time now, which I thought was kind of strange because it's not something that all Muslims agree on.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go back to the phones and talk to Wajid. He's calling us from Canton, Michigan. Wajid, hi. Thanks for giving us a call.
Hey, Susan, how are you doing?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call. I just have a comment. I'm also from Pakistan. I lived there for 25 years, and then I came to the United States for higher studies, and I have been here for 17 years now. But I just have a comment, like, on what Ali was mentioning about, like, the madrasas. I've been there for, like, 25 years, and I have seen, like, no violence as far as, like, and I have also seen, like, no madrasas. I'm from Karachi, and there are some very good madrasas which also teaches, like, all the, like, latest and greatest technologies and everything with Islamic knowledge. So I don't know what Ali is saying is 100% correct, because I have been through what he is talking about. Like, I have been there for 25 years, never experienced any kind of problem. No one has ever forced me. And when USSR invaded Afghanistan, then all of a sudden we start seeing, like, all these madrasas coming along and everything. And when USSR left, we have not seen since 1990 till 2004, there is no suicide bombing in Pakistan. There was no suicide bombing. And then after 2005 and 2006,
suddenly it started again.
All right, Wajid, thank you for your call.
The madrasas that Wajid is talking about, he's talking about the seminaries, and that is what the madrasa used to be. The word madrasa comes from, you know, I think the 10th century in Islam, where it was a university, and Muslims were the first people to really kind of systemize education in the form of a university, in the terms of a college. And the madrasas are that, you know, children of that institution. And so in Karachi, in Lahore, in some of the larger cities, there are these big seminaries, and you learn religious knowledge, and you also learn science and technology there. But, you know, they also exist in these smaller kind of rural environments, and even within neighborhoods there, where people really are only reading Quran and not much else.
We're talking to Ali Etiraz about his new memoir. It's called Children of Dust, A Memoir of Pakistan. We're going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll go to the phones and we'll read some of your emails. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
Pakistan has an estimated 80 to 100 nuclear warheads. Are they safe or at risk of getting in the hands of extremists? And what precautions has the U.S. taken to help secure the weapons? On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. He writes about Pakistan's nuclear weapons in the current New Yorker. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Ali Etiraz, you write in your book that when you went back to Pakistan, you were in search of a pious wife. What were you looking for?
The definition of pious, you know, among American Muslim males has pretty much been pretty standard. You know, somebody who wears the head covering and wears loose clothing and intends to stay home, not work.
And so what did you find?
Well, I got exposed to kind of the urban city girls in Karachi, which is a very cosmopolitan part of Pakistan, and they were not like that at all. So I almost felt like, you know, tricked that I came and looking in Pakistan, a Muslim country, and these girls didn't really exist.
So what kind of young women are you looking for now?
I'm kind of keeping to myself on that, but on the whole, you know, now it's more about who a person is and what they're about than what they wear.
Would a woman's faith be an important aspect of her to you when you're thinking about a relationship?
To an extent, yeah, it does make a difference.
You know, we've gotten several emails that talk about the concept of an infidel. Here's one from Don in Kentucky. He says, is it possible to either remove or counter the phrase, kill the infidel, or do you think this phrase is proper? And Bill in Dallas writes us and says, Please ask your guest why Islam is so intolerant of the non-believer. Is it personal insecurity or something else that leads to the earthly persecution of so-called infidels rather than faithfully letting whatever God that there might be deal with them in the afterlife?
If we're talking about removing verses from the Quran that discuss the, you know, non-Muslims, that's unlikely. You know, religious people are unlikely, not very willing to remove stuff from their texts. But what has to happen with Islam, Islamic theology that we're talking about, is a contextual reading of the Quran, that you look at the Quran and you say, what is the context in which this verse is discussed? You know, is it a time of war? Is it a time of peace? And a lot of this is taking place now. This is something that people are not paying attention to when it does get discussed in the media. It's almost like when that introspective, you know, discussion takes place among Muslims, nobody really... It's not very exciting. I mean, let's be honest. It's a bunch of theologians talking about arcane, you know, dogma, and people just want to have them, you know, declare resolution at the end of it, which they'll pick up or not, depending on, you know, what their time constraints are or whatever. So that discussion, the 20th century has been very fruitful for Islam in many ways, and in terms of the discussion about modernity. The other question about the violence, you know, if you follow the news, you know that the great majority of victims of terror attacks are Muslims. They are average Muslims who are just like average Americans, you know, just trying to earn their living. And I mean, it's gone so bad, for example, in Pakistan with the amount of Muslim death that nobody even really keeps a tally anymore of how many people have been killed by other people acting in the name of Islam. So I kind of, you know, get reluctant to just make this a Muslim versus infidel thing, because it's not.
Let's talk to Chloe. She's calling us from Miami Beach. Chloe, thanks for holding on.
Oh, yes. Good morning. And yes, I'm looking forward to reading your book, Mr. Etteraz.
Thank you.
And very much so. And I commend you for, you know, talking in this very sort of lucid, rational, reformist way about something that's really such a passionate subject for people who are believers. And your approach is in contrast. And I remember living in France when a lot of the young Muslim girls were marching and protesting and very angry in the street because they were demanding that wearing the veil be tolerated in public schools. And the French state, you know, is a secular state, and they wouldn't let them wear the veil. And the girls were saying, oh, well, you know, you have to be tolerant and let us wear the veil. And I'm often wishing that they would be marching for tolerance and pluralism and outside of France in the Western world. So I'm always wondering why Muslims living in the West don't do more to not just be, you know, aggrieved when they don't get tolerance, but also demand the same kind of reciprocity and tolerance and pluralism in traditional Muslim societies. That was one question. And then a quick follow-up question, because you kind of alluded to it earlier. Would you premise that a lot of religions, almost all the religions, are basically acting as political parties today?
All right, Chloe, thanks for your call.
Very loaded question. Chloe, thanks for the question. And I know I don't want to, you know, kind of disappoint her, but first of all, I mean, if we're talking about France, as an American, I don't agree with the kind of secular mandate that the French state imposes on everyone, which is the same thing that the Turkish government used to do. And I'm more of a libertarian. I feel that people should be able to practice religion however they want, and until they're you know, they just should be able to make their own decisions. And I think that a lot of people, now there's a lot of discussion in Europe as to whether their approach to religious tolerance or liberty is the correct one. And in many ways, they're looking to the United States as a model. So I don't know if France is really the should be the benchmark. Having said that, the idea of Muslims being kind of asked to rise up and speak out and make marches and parades is something that hasn't caught on amongst Muslims in the West, because it first of all, it seems artificial, because it's being driven not by the Muslim community themselves, but by pundits and by people who want to see a symbolic gesture. But I think the biggest symbolic gesture is that Western Muslims, for the most part, do not engage in those kind of acts. They engage in very day-to-day activities. And I think that should be more than sufficient for a Muslim to do. You know, I just find the idea of collective responsibilities heaped upon Muslims a little troubling, because you, first of all communities are, you know, you cannot treat people like collectives, because then you're potentially dealing with the idea of collective punishment or collective retribution if they fail to act in a particular way. So I think that Muslim leaders should utter all the condemnations that, you know, they feel qualified to utter. I feel that other than that, the best act that a Muslim can do as far as resisting violence is to not engage in it themselves.
Let's go to Dallas, Texas, and talk to Karun. Good morning.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking the call. My question is that I'm from India, and I'm Punjabi myself. So, you know, my parents and my grandparents came from Pakistan. That was before, you know, India and Pakistan separated in two different countries. And I have a lot of Indian, you know, being from India, I have a lot of Muslim friends, and I was in the Indian Army. And the only memories I have about Muslims being from India are such wonderful friendship, you know, that I've had even till today, that I talk to those people. And so my question is that India is probably number three or number four in terms of the number of Muslims that live within the country. Do you feel that there is a difference between the, you know, in terms of their thought process or their ethics or morality issues or anything like that for Muslims living in India and some of the other countries where there are problems these days, like Iran, Iraq, you know, Pakistan? You know, because I'm very confused about Muslims living in different countries and having different perceptions in one country, not having so many issues with Muslims like I do, and then there are, you know, in Pakistan, which is a predominantly Muslim country, having such serious issues of, you know, violence and all that kind of stuff.
All right, Karun, thanks for giving us a call.
Thanks for that question. Actually, you know, I discussed this story in my book just to mention what he's talking about, how his parents went from Punjab in the Pakistani side to India, I believe. We were the reverse. We came from Indian Punjab and into Pakistan. And, you know, the story my grandparents discuss in the book. But the question of how and why Muslims are sort of different than in India than they are in Muslim majority states is interesting, because I think that what has happened in a number of Muslim majority states is that the lack of a real minority religion in many of these places has made the discussion about religion very, very one-sided. And within the one-sided discussion, it's in many times been hijacked by extreme fundamentalists with political agendas. And just to focus on Pakistan for a little bit, you know, the Jamaat-e-Islami party, which was kind of the big Islamist movement in the 50s, 60s, and not so much anymore, but who were really in many ways responsible for taking Pakistan into a Islamic state direction, because Pakistan was not founded as an Islamic state. And to take it to that point, there was a lot of agitation and a lot of activism that they did in Pakistan. And there were really no countervailing voices. There were no Hindu voices that, for the most, I mean, there were, you know, here and there a Hindu individual who was still in Pakistan, here and there a Christian individual. And I think that what really hurt Pakistan was the breakup in 1971 of East Pakistan and West Pakistan, when East Pakistan became Bangladesh. The Bangladeshis, who previously were Pakistanis, had a more multicultural approach to Islam, and they had a longer tradition of a multicultural approach, whereas the Western Pakistanis didn't. And in a way, that was the conflict even before 71, this kind of multicultural embrace of religion, right, and against this kind of antagonistic approach to religion. And that, after we, you know, the Pakistanis lost the Bengali Muslims, it became even more difficult in Pakistan.
We have an email from Anna, who writes us from Tacoma Park, and she says, I'm an African-American woman, and I used to be married to a very nice Pakistani man for 5 years. I always felt that I had to defend the black community to him and his friends. They sometimes had negative comments about not only the black community, but other minorities as well, and they treated me as if I was the exception to the rule. I just wanted your guest to comment on some of the stereotypes and misconceptions that many Pakistanis living here in the United States have toward other minority groups and where these feelings may have come from.
That's a good question, Anna. As a younger Pakistani and as a younger Muslim, there is a pretty big conversation amongst us about the kind of superior attitude that immigrant Muslims take towards African American Muslims. And it's absolutely a problem. I've seen it with my own eyes. My dad actually is someone who's kind of always fought against it. He's always been very, you know, has always reached out a lot to African American communities. But the fact remains that across the U.S., there is a gulf between African American Muslims and immigrant Muslims, and that does extend to racism in many cases. I think that it's starting to be overcome. Some of the bigger religious institutions around the bigger mosques around the country have African American leaders, and you know, there are a number of traditional African American Muslim leaders that have come to the fore. You know, there's professors and scholars that are coming up, and I think that they are able to, you know, illustrate to immigrant Muslims that this is not an issue of race. I mean, we are all kind of Americans and co-religionists, and I think that it's going to be addressed, and it is being addressed.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. You know, we've gotten a couple of emails that go to the large question of the future of relations between the Islamic world and the Christian world. Here's one from Jeffrey, who writes us from Nashport, Ohio. He says, is there a solution to the eternal conflict between Islam and Christianity? Why must there be conflict? I believe that there always will be, but that it doesn't need to be there. I believe we all pray to the same God, but just in a different fashion. And another email that we've gotten writes, I was listening to Karen Armstrong this weekend on Speaking of Faith. She discussed how secular conflicts become more irreconcilable when religion becomes part of the debate. She seems somewhat pessimistic that conflicts can be resolved at that point. And the author seems to point this out also. Is he as pessimistic that the secular conflicts can be resolved once religion becomes the vernacular?
I'm probably not the right person to ask these questions to and give answers. I can, you know, barely get to my appointments on time sometimes. But, you know, I think it's in a strange way the figure of Iblis, Satan, answered the question in the Quran because he said he made us all children of dust. You know, he made us all creations of one, like, component. And there has to be an attempt by all of us simultaneously to recognize our joint origins, if you will, and how we go about doing that and what stories we tell one another is how that is going to happen. We have to share our subjective paralysis and our subjective, you know, schizophrenia with one another and be willing to kind of be castigated and judged and exposed. I mean, in the writing of this book, in my own spiritual journey, I felt extremely exposed. I feel naked a lot of times. And, you know, people are always asking me, well, you must love doing this book tour. And I'm like, no, I don't like it at all, because I feel the entire time, I feel like I put myself out there without really any guarantee that my expression will be reciprocated in kind, and the hope is that it will be, that other people will be willing to tell their stories. And I think that is how we can find our shared place.
So your book, a lot of it is about finding your identity or defining your identity as a Muslim. And so today, how would you define yourself? Are you a practicing Muslim now?
I would consider myself a practicing Muslim. You know, I'm definitely not communal in terms of my practice.
So you don't go to a mosque?
Generally, no, I don't. I observed some elements of Ramadan and some I didn't. And I pray sometimes and I don't. And, you know, that is really, for the large part of my life, I felt like I had to do this stuff even if I didn't feel inclined to. And that really bred a lot of hypocrisy within myself, which is one of, you know, the biggest problems that I've faced in my life.
And so why did you decide to write this book?
To be honest with myself, especially with regard to religion, to not utilize it as a tool for masking my own insecurities and weaknesses, and to expose myself to myself and acquire, like I said in the beginning of the book to acquire sovereignty over myself. And it wasn't just about identity, because identity, you know, you can know who you are, but until you know what you are and how you operate, you know, it's really meaningless. So it is in that way a very personal book, and a very scary to write book in many ways.
Ali Attaraz, he is the author of Children of Dust, a memoir of Pakistan. Thank you so much for joining us this hour on The Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much, Susan.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.